I'm Ernest Grant, Jr. I was born and raised in Tuskegee. And other than school and the military service, I've lived here all my life.
Do you remember your grandparents?
Of course I remember my grandparents. My grandparents?
Yeah.
Of course I do.
What did they do?
Well, on which side?
Okay.
Well, of course my grandparents are deceased. Okay. But I had one set of grandparents from Cleveland, Tennessee, and I had another set of grandparents from Beaufort, South Carolina.
Yeah.
Right. Now, I remember my grandmother on my father's side, but I don't remember my grandfather. And on my mother's side, I remember both my grandfather and my grandmother. And I guess they were what you might say self-employed, which was the lot of black people in Cleveland, Tennessee. Cleveland, Tennessee, of course, is about 35 miles from Chattanooga. And
did they ever talk about segregation?
They didn't have to because I was right there and I saw it with my own eyes. And so, in Beaufort, South Carolina, it's very fresh. And in my mind, it's very fresh, and of course, in Cleveland, Tennessee. And of course, the same thing applies for Tuskegee. So, but my mother and father were on the faculty at Tuskegee. Right. So my mother was in the school system, and then, of course, my father was on the faculty here at Tuskegee until he died. So I knew the political problems and racial problems that we had here in Tuskegee. So,
do you remember any stories that your parents had, or any early memories of your stuff?
Well, I know that there's so many, as I said before.
Right. It was shared again.
Okay, yeah, it was nothing. Okay, okay. It was nothing for, we had a Avon lady who was white, and we had insurance men, and most of them were white. they would walk right in the door without even knocking or anything. And as a result, they would address my mother and the other black women by their first name. And so even as kids, it wasn't unusual in some households for the insurance man to try to give us some money and tell us to go to the store and buy a cookie in an attempt to leave the black women with the white guy. So almost everybody became aware of that in all areas, Mobile, Alabama, most of the areas that I know about. But anyway, this particular gentleman walked in the front door, and my mother was ironing with a smoothing iron. And he walked up behind her and grabbed her bust, and she turned around with that smoothing iron and hugged him with it. And she burnt him very badly. And the big problem was there were some other ladies there, and in the commotion, he wasn't able to really identify my mother as the one that hugged him with iron. But that was, I've forgotten, I must have been about 7 or 8 years old then. And I never forgot that. So that extended right on through high school. Yeah, my father had to take my mother out away from Tuskegee to Tennessee in the trunk of the car. And she stayed up there over a year.
Did your whole family move?
Well, we had to. Yeah, we had to. Well, my father, of course, came back to Tuskegee because he was working here. But he left my mother and my sister and myself in Tennessee. And that lasted for over a year. And I never, ever forgot that. So I grew up, obviously, I'm 63 years old. I was born in 1931. So I grew up in the turbulent area. The Klan used to march right up our street on Washington Avenue. It's the same Washington Avenue, right. And
how was the people in the neighborhood respond when they walk up the street?
With great difficulty. We had clashes from here and there, but what happened was that you couldn't buy, if you went to the hardware store or went to a store in Montgomery, the only thing you could buy was 22 short rounds. There was no other ammunition available. And since there was no ammunition available, how you doing? I'll be through in a few minutes. I'm sorry, I'm doing an interview. That extended right on up to through the integration of the arms forces, which Truman, I think, did in 49, 50s, right in there somewhere. And that was supposed to be the law of the land, but it didn't get down to the other areas. And so as a result, we were segregated and not segregated. It depended on the circumstances.
Did you remember the first time you voted here in Tuskegee?
Sure, I remember, because I didn't get registered. My father was a registered voter. He was a registered voter, I guess, because he had a PhD. And if you were the right kind of black person, they would...
You said you had to be of a certain stature. What do you mean by that?
Well, you know, you had not only was there a poll tax, but you had to... The Board of Registrars would ask you questions about the Constitution, and you had to interpret the Constitution to their satisfaction. And there were a few blacks that they would permit to vote. They put you on the list, but they were very few.
So your father did vote?
He did. Okay.
Uh-huh. So was it because you had a PhD?
That's the only possible reason I can think of. Uh-huh. But it was very limited. And sometimes the women could get things they could go in the store and buy stuff and get credit that the black man with a PhD and everything else couldn't get.
Do you remember the gerrymandering?
Of course I remember it. I remember every piece of it.
Could you explain it?
Well, what happened was that they redefined the city limits of Tuskegee. Okay. Now, in the process of doing this, it put most of the registered voters out of the city limits, which means that you could not vote on any local officials. So you couldn't vote on any of the officials of Tuskegee. You couldn't vote on the mayor, in any of the municipal election, you were not permitted to vote because you were not a registered voter anymore. So they put every registered vote, black registered voter, out of the city limits except 10. So you know I'm a...
Right. Except 10. Who were those chosen?
I don't remember who they were. But I'm trying to think of the gentleman who sponsored that election. But he was that sponsored that. Gerrymandering, but if I remember correctly, he was from somewhere near Short, Alabama.
Could you describe some of the changes that have taken place since then and now, if there are anything?
Well, there are quite a few, quite a few changes, because what happened was the composition of the municipal officials changed. For the first time, we had a black sheriff, and he's the first black sheriff since Reconstruction. And of course, I knew him personally. Sheriff Amerson, Lucius Amerson. And he was really tough, because it wasn't long after he became sheriff, a lot of individuals thought that he wasn't going to be an effective sheriff. And so there was an individual who picked up a black guy, carried him out to the practice range, and decided, well, we're going to make this guy tap dance. And so they kept shooting at his feet and what have you. But anyway, he went down. No, he didn't do the sheriff that way. He did this, but the individual went to the sheriff and complained.
Oh, yeah.
And the sheriff went to Notasulka and arrested the policeman, the highway patrolman. I don't know whether it was a highway patrolman or not, but the two officials, both of them were law officers, and arrested both of them. And that convinced the other white officials that Lucius Amerson was for real. So then they had a number of tapes that they used to play that it was real popular among the white people. And it had to do with jokes, what have you, the racial jokes.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And all.
Did they play them over or something?
There was one called The High Sheriff, for example. That was the name of the tape. And most of the white people had it.
So what type of things would be on the tape?
It would just be this conversation between these two white guys, and they were talking about, have you heard about our new nigger sheriff we have, and so on and everything and all. And then they had somebody who would mimic the sheriff, and the point was it was kind of a parody, and he was supposed to go out and arrest a white man. And Amerson was saying, well, the sheriff was supposed to say, you want me to go and rest, come on, say Amerson Andy type thing, that's got this truck with the Confederate flag and the pearl handle pistols and the shotgun and everything. I said, you want me to go and arrest him? Well, I don't know where those recordings are, but I'd give anything to find them. But it made us so angry, though, and your rage can consume you and also get you killed. And so a lot of times you have to put it aside and let common sense prevail.
What were people's reactions to those tapes?
For us, it was disgusting, but in a way it set our task before us, and we knew what we were going to have to do.
And
No. I don't know anything about. The only lynching I can remember is back the one that took place in Georgia, and that was a long time ago. That was back when I was much younger. Lynching usually has something to do with a lynch mob and a noose and all that, but I think in this case right here, these people were just assassinated. There were four blacks that were assassinated. Two of the women recognized some of the white individuals, and as a result, they were killed too. And a lot of this had to do with just a white man would say something to a black person, and he would reply, and then they would show up. Now, I do recall, though, that there was a lady who was an extremely good seamstress, and she got a lot of white business. And the white people in Tuskegee complained because they were losing business on account of her. But she was also extremely good with firearms. So some of the local white officials decided they'd go over and teach her a lesson. And they showed up, which was right across the street, mind you, from where I live.
On Washington Avenue,
right there at the corner. So they decided they'd go over and intimidate her. But she intimidated them because everybody that she shot at, she hit.
How many of them? About two
or three. And it was beyond belief. And they were local officials and everything and all, and so they never tried that again. And so, with the sheets and everything and all, it because the sheet comes unimportant if you're shot, if you're hit. Okay. And these individuals turned out to be our local merchants and a couple of other guests invited in from West Point, Georgia, if I remember correctly. They didn't make any secret of where they were from.
Oh, yeah?
No, they used to stand on the corner, robe, the whole works right there on the corner. And see, on Washington Avenue and Scott Street, where I live, it used to be a very convenient place for the Caucasians to pass through. Now, Washington Avenue doesn't extend all the way to the place that it does now, but it's a convenient place to attempt to intimidate people. So.
Do you remember the syphilis thing over there?
Of course I do. But at the time all this was going on, I was about eighth grade, and I remember seeing a posted sign on the telephone pole that said that all black males 18 years or older had to report for a blood test.
That's what it's
right. Well, I wasn't 18 years old. I was 15 or 16, if I remember correctly. Anyway, so I went with some of my friends who were 18. And they went over to John Andrew Hospital and got a blood test and all. You know, we were puzzled because we couldn't figure out why just us. And so it was some time later, but we had some physicians here who were either interning at John Andrew Hospital, but they were involved in it. And it was years later before we were able to put it together, but when you kind of lived through it, you still don't attach anything to it. But I do remember the older guys in my group happened to go for a blood test.
So did they come down with the symptoms later?
Oh, I have no idea. I have no idea, because I didn't know the individuals who might have had syphilis from the ones that didn't. But I do remember the sign that was on the pole.
What was the relationship between the university and the community?
Extremely good. Now, if there ever was a Tuskegee family, that was it. Yeah, when I was coming up. Very close relationship between the Tuskegee community. And in fact, we were one.
How about the dog track?
Well, there wasn't any dog track then, you know. Nobody even thought about a dog track. Yeah. Oh, yeah, much, much later. See, the dog track hasn't been here long. Now, what happened was the Institute and the Tuskegee community kind of went this, well, it was bound to happen because we used to depend on Tuskegee Institute for everything. We used to get our electricity. Tuskegee Institute used to have its own system. It was completely independent. There used to be a track, a railroad track that brought coal into the, yeah. And so it had its own generating plant and everything. Yeah. And so it had its own generators. And what happened was, as the loads got greater, naturally, the amount of electricity available became less and less. And when we got fluorescent lights, you had to turn the fluorescent lights on early in the morning before the load got too high, because if you ever turned them off in the middle of the day, you could never turn them back on again because the voltage wasn't high enough to start them.
Did you have a car?
But, well, my father had a car. Yeah, a 39 Chevrolet.
Did you all go on family trips?
We went on family trips, but it was an ordeal. I hate to even think about it. It was terrible. We used to go to Montgomery, and when you went to Montgomery, there were a few places that you could go in Montgomery. There were a couple of places you could go and eat. So fixing your lunch got to be an expected thing. The same way with the train. We had a train used to come to Chee Hall.
Could you share some of your experiences?
They are all they're all bad, but anyway, when the train came through, there was a Crescent Limited, there was a South Wind, there were a bunch of them. The big problem was that the Black Star used to be up in the front behind the tender. You know what the tender is on the steam? Well, you know, have a fireman.
Right.
Okay. And this fireman, oh, you're thinking about an automatic stoker. I'm talking about the kind where you have a shovel.
Right, that's what I was saying.
Right. But anyway, make a long story short, the cars right next to the engine and the tender. Okay, I'll have to talk to you in just a little bit.
Okay.
All right. When the train stopped, you got on, but you boarded up in the front. And that's where all the smoke and everything else. Because remember, this is old-fashioned steam engine. So all the cinders and everything else.
Could you be right there with that?
Right behind, right. The smoke, the whole shebang. And then when you got on, you were next to all the dirt and everything else that was there.
That's
just the reverse.
Do you remember the Freedom Train?
Of course I remember the Freedom Train. How can I forget? We had several instances, we had incidents right down at our bus station now. This is a small town. We knew the people that ran the bus line here. And all of us did. Well, the Freedom Train was not quite as bad as the Freedom Bus. You know, when everything got supposedly integrated and everything, the Freedom Riders, let's put it that way. And naturally there were, we made a lot of white enemies along the way, and they tried to make it as difficult for us as possible. But what you had to do, in 1963 was a pretty impressive year for most of us. You know, that was the year, if I remember correctly, or it may have been before, I've forgotten exactly when. we decided we were going to test the desegregation laws and everything and all. But apparently they hadn't got to a number of areas. And at that time, George Wallace was something to deal with. You better believe it. The George Wallace that we have right there, you know. And the one that's still up in the schoolhouse door. And it's funny that, and then even the newspaper, the Montgomery Advertiser, they used to have one little page that went in there, or at least two. And that would be delivered to people who got the Montgomery Advertiser if you were black. If you weren't black, that page wasn't in there. It was kind of a page that's kind of stuck in the Montgomery Advertiser. It'd be news for colored people.
So, what are the ways that you receive news?
There wasn't any news other than there was a radio, but the radio primarily was all white. It wasn't, you know, they had a little, what did they call that program? But anyway, they had a program on the radio on Sunday. They had a program that was targeted to black communities. And I don't know, it was transmitted by WAPI, if I remember correctly, which was out of Birmingham. And that would be black news. There'd be a little black news, and there'd be some spirituals and what have you, and so on and on. That was about it.
What about on campus? Did any of your classes deal with that? Whole voting and the process education?
Sure. Education? Sure. That's if there ever was a time now, during that time, history got to be an extremely important item for everybody. And you couldn't afford to miss the boat. And by that, if you're going to take a course that involves what used to be and the way it is now, you find yourself in great difficulty. Because you're more interested in Black history and what's going on, you with me, than ancient history. And in this particular case, it wasn't a case of being interested in the legend of Pharaoh and King Tut. That, right. This was basically what has happened during your lifetime. And I've forgotten which classes they were. Yeah, but what he did was if I remember correctly, he went to the Library of Congress and put his notes, you with me? Put his notes together by his own efforts, which is a little different than taking the notes from somebody else and translating those. He did those since then. And it was apparent that he knew, he knew every single detail. And what it did was it fired us up because we got real interested too. Yeah.
So was he, Dr. Tolan, a motivator on the campus?
You better well believe it. Because he made me the way I am.
Yeah.
I hated the course because I had to work so hard. Were you ever taught by him?
Yeah.
Well, you know, he did not play. He did not play any kind of way, you know. And he would ask you to discuss something, and I mean, you had to have all the dates and everything. But on the other hand, you couldn't afford, ignorance now was something you couldn't afford. So that's kind of the way it went. But
so he taught voter education?
Yeah. In fact, if you didn't know why the right to vote was so important, if you didn't know before, you sure knew afterwards. And of course, now my daughter never took a course from Dr. Tolan, but she was very impressed by him. She's an attorney, Montgomery now, and of course she handles a lot of cases that involve interracial, and it was kind of tough because she went to Auburn, and then she went from Auburn to the University of Alabama. So you can imagine the problem. Yeah, she's one of these activists anyway.
Yeah,
she's one of these Black activists anyway. So she will. She's a deputy attorney general of the state of Alabama, and she had all kinds of problems there. But almost everybody did that was Black, So you had to kind of watch your step, so to speak.
Do you remember Otis Pinker?
Of course, I know Otis Pinker. Yeah. I know Otis Pinker. I've been knowing Otis Pinker all my life. Yeah. And he's been real active, too. And he's always been like that. One thing about him, he's consistent. And that means a lot. Because anytime you have a person that has a philosophy that varies with the seasons, then you don't know who you can count on and who you can't, because it depends on what the political expediency happens to be. But he's never been like that. And I've known him all my life, as I said before, And we aren't the greatest of friends because that's not what it's all about. Okay, so you might say we're professional friends. Okay, I expect him to tell me the truth about whatever the philosophy, of whatever philosophy he believes in, and I tell him the same thing.
Was there a Black business district in this area?
Was that a black business?
District.
Yeah, so to speak.
Where was it?
It was just scattered. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, just scattered through the community, you know. You have a store here, and you know. And if they didn't have it, then you had to go downtown. Oh, you better well believe it. I think there was one little section there uptown by the jailhouse, where the jailhouse used to be. Well, you know where the jailhouse is now, right?
Right.
Okay. It was in that same site. But that was the only way you could make it. You either had to be an undertaker. I was trying to think of a black attorney. There had to be one, but I don't know who it was. And no. And of course, I knew Dr. Chameleon. I've known Dr. Chameleon all my life. But anyway, I guess what I'm saying is that most of the black business, we had black doctors. But I don't know many black attorneys right offhand, you know.
Did you have any interaction with the VA hospital?
No, other than the kind you ordinarily have with the community and the hospital and the school, you know. But it was nice, I mean, you know.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Do you remember the incident where they tried to have an all-black administration?
No, I probably wasn't here then. I didn't go to college here, and I couldn't because I couldn't go to Auburn. Auburn was segregated. The School of Engineering wasn't accredited, and so we had what we call out-of-state aid. If you were a black person, and you want to attend a segregated school, the state of Alabama would give you the difference between what it costs to go there and here. And yeah.
So you went to the service?
Well, yeah, but I'm just saying, but I went to Drake University. When I went to Drake University, the state of Alabama paid the difference between what it cost me to go to Auburn University and to go to Drake University.
Did you run into that
thing? Of course. And how? It's everywhere you go. Yeah. As a black engineer, it's tough now, you know. So, but you deal with it.
How were your classes? Did they treat you as though you were less than
you? Well, if you want to have an incident where the person calls me number 25.
Really?
And after about four or five class meetings, I asked this gentleman, I asked the teacher, I said, why do you keep calling me number 25? He said, well, there's no point in me learning your name. Because, nigga, you ain't gonna be here long enough. Now, he's my teacher. And so when he got to that, he would just say, you know, when he was checking the roll,
he would call everyone else by their name.
By their name, call me number 25.
So what was your
You're between a rock and a hard place. I told him, I said, well, you might as well learn my name, because I'm not dropping this course. I'm gonna be here. And he would ask me, no, the guy turned out to be the best friend I ever had.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because I happened to be going to a school where most of the individuals in my class had wealthy parents and all the other stuff that goes with it, and lots of influence. I noticed they didn't do much work.
No.
And I kept trying to figure out, how in the world are they going to pass this course if they don't really buckle down? Right, and so what would happen was, he said, I didn't want you to get caught in that trap. He says, you notice that the other individuals in your class don't seem to do much of anything. He said, but all their parents have to do is buy a new wing for so-and-so, and so donate $100,000 or $200,000 to so-and-so, and so, and their kids get out and graduate. But you, on the other hand, are going to have to study, because I know you don't have any money. If you had the money, you wouldn't be here. And he was right.
Would you rather see that same thing in the military?
Oh, yeah. Don't even mention the military. That was beyond belief. And it got worse and worse and worse, you know. In fact, there was one other guy, and we got paranoid because we figured it was going to be a race war.
Really?
Yeah, almost everybody did because everybody was stealing ammo, stealing weapons.
Did
you? No. No, I didn't need to steal any weapons.
How would they steal?
What do you mean? You have a supply sergeant. Oh, there were all kinds of ways of doing that, but don't misunderstand now. The mafia-type individuals did not, they were interested in the dollar. They didn't care anything about the profit motive. They didn't, we had some individuals that were dedicated to improving the lot of the black man. It's simple. You're on a truck and it's loaded with weapons. You just throw one off the truck every once in a while and some other people come along the car and pick it up. So pretty soon. It's as simple as that, you know. Oh yeah. So things got real nice after that because pretty soon our local merchants realized that there were a lot of veterans from the Korean conflict here, and they were extremely well armed. They had panzer faust. You know what a panzer faust is? A panzer faust is a gigantic rocket launcher, and one round from that takes the side of the whole building away. So there's no point of hiding in the building because one round from that would mean the whole side of the building disappears. Panzer faust, that's a German name. As far as Super Bazooka, the 3.2 rocket launcher, okay, it was a 2.8, if I remember correctly. Then they went to the 3.2. And it's a, uh-oh. When we went to NASA, they were talking about the man landing on the moon and everything and all. Al Dean, at the time, carried us to a segregated eating facility. They went inside and ate in Albertsville, Alabama. And we sat out there in the car with a sandwich. And that was our dean of the School of Engineering.
That's right.
No, right here, Tuskegee.
Yeah, sure.
No.
What year
that? That was in 1963. When we went, we went to an IEEE meeting. The dean, Dr. Clayton and myself and another gentleman, black, in a car and gave us $160 apiece. And we drove all the way to New York to the convention. The rest of them flew. That's a fact. They flew.
So what did you all do?
What did we do? Well, we wanted to go.
Right.
We wanted to go, so that's what we did. So you're really talking to the wrong person because, see, I get angry every time I think about that. But that's what happened. The department head flew. So we met them in New York. They were getting off the plane.
Was there any discussion over why?
Yeah. But it didn't help. We had, they hired some faculty from Auburn who came over and taught, but they taught at night. Now they were a member of the faculty at Tuskegee Institute, but they wanted to pursue their graduate degree. So they went and pursued their graduate degree. I'm not the kind of person want to talk to because you can imagine what kind of attitude I have about all of this. So they made our black kids come to class at night while they pursued a daytime curriculum. Yeah, well, that's right. Extended right up to the 70s. So, but when we used to go on these trips, and the thing about this, now remember, now Tuskegee Institute is supposed to be paying for all of this. But what this individual, now he's dean. We get in the car with him. They stopped at a nice restaurant, go in and eat and enjoy themselves. We can't go in there because it's segregated.
Right.
So they go in there and bring us a sandwich. That's how, that's the way it went. I was born and raised, I've been here over 30 years. Yeah, so,
teaching here 30 years,
yeah, born and raised here, so I have an attitude. And they was, I said before, they were going to school at Auburn. We had to quit our job, pack up, and leave and move north to pursue a graduate degree because we couldn't get in any of the other white schools. Yeah, of course. Well, I mean, you didn't have to like me, but see, we were vets by that time, and so you'd have to be crazy mess with a vet. You were asking to get killed. You know.
Yeah, with those weapons, did anybody ever use them?
I don't know, but I know nobody bothered anybody.
Because you were a vet.
And I learned every weapon there was. Everyone. Everyone.
They were weapons.
Everybody really had a chip on their shoulder. We had made up our mind when we went to service that we weren't going, when we came back to the South, that wasn't going to ever happen again. Ever. And if we had to go down, we were just going to go down. That's a fact. We were committed to that because we had had enough. And somehow they figured out that we weren't playing. Treated like a treated at
in
oh, as black veterans?
Yeah.
Oh, come on. Doing an interview, I'll be doing a few minutes.
Okay.
Terrible. There were no jobs in Philadelphia. No jobs in Philadelphia for blacks. In Montgomery, you probably didn't know it, but to drive a yellow cab, you had to have a college degree. Did you know that?
In 40s
or 50s? No, up to the 60s. Why don't you check it out and see? Check it out and see. Your eligibility for being a cab driver with yellow cab, you had to have a degree, a college degree. You had to be a college graduate. Well, it was targeted at black folks, I guess. And you can check that out and you'll find it. Okay. If you had a college degree, you could get a job with, and you were black, you could get a job as a cab driver with Yellow Cab Company. There's a lot you don't know. You check it out and you'll find out that I'm telling you the truth. Yeah. See. So you can see what kind of personality conflict I have. So.
So were you treated very different because your parents were
not
institutes?
Not really. No, no. No. No, because we were all between a rock and a hard place. No, I don't ever recall getting any special attention because of the fact that my parents were professionals.
Yeah, and you had a sister?
I had one sister. Yeah.
Were there any hard times in the family? Like, how did you... The family
that survived. Well, a hard time, of course, when my mother came down with breast carcinoma, my father spent every dime he had. She died just the same. But, and it took about 5 years to die, but die she did. But when she died, the only thing my father couldn't cash then was his life insurance policy with Tuskegee Institute. He couldn't get that, which I think was worth about $2,000. He had $2,000 life insurance. And the bills were beyond belief. So we didn't get those. My father was dead and in his grave, and we still hadn't paid off all of it.
Did he ever share with you how he survived the depression? Was that a hard time for
him? Yeah, it was a hard time for everybody. Have you been to Montgomery, haven't you?
Yeah.
You ever see the sign that says Mighty Lean?
Mighty Lean.
Mighty Lean, M-I-T-Y-L-E-N-E. You've never seen that sign. You know where you get off. If you were, when you go into Montgomery and decide to get off the first, get off at Mighty Lean exit, when you get off there, you go right on into the outer outskirts of Montgomery Vine. Okay. You know what I'm talking about there? Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, where they have some nice houses and everything out there and everything, and all where the white folks and everything, where the dean used to live there. You know what I'm talking about now?
The dean
of engineering. Okay. Yeah. Yeah, that's mighty lean. But that mighty lean means what it says, mighty lean. How are things? How are things going? It's mighty lean. Mighty lean means mighty means big, and lean means nothing, doesn't it? Mighty lean times. That's the way it used to be expressed. These are mighty lean times because there's no jobs, no nothing for blacks. You with me? No cotton. You know, there's a mighty lean year. Mighty lean year because the cotton, the Vogue have gotten the cotton. You with me? Mighty lean because the cotton gin has laid off most of the sin, has nothing to do. That's how the name got to be, mighty lean. See, my father was an ag man, so I used to travel with him. I used to travel with him all over the state and everything and all, you know. And he used to go out and visit farmers. He had, you know, because he had a lot of students here.
Did he remember Dr. Carver?
I used to go on field trips with Dr. Carver. What are you talking about? I used to go on field trips with Dr. Carver.
Could you share some of your experiences?
Except that, yeah.